Hello there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion of healthcare and health politics in the news, answers to your emails and your phone calls, live here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Welcome. But before we go any further, as usual, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, settle back in your chairs, and we got quite a lot of feedback from our show last week on single payer. And I want to start by leading off with an email, one of these bits of feedback from Dick in Santa Cruz. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Excellent show today. Really valued your dialogue with Lorna Grundemann with a focus on single-payer healthcare. Lots of hard work ahead. Unfortunately, doctors and nurses were arrested last week for saying out loud single-payer during their protest before the Senate Finance Committee. Although the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is at the table, single-payer advocates are not invited. Senator Max Baucus, the Democratic chair of the Senate Finance Committee, has received over $4 million in contributions from the healthcare industry, and he won't allow single-payer folks at the table. Well, since you wrote that, Dick, we have had a hearing. We've had our foot through the door, but I have been just fascinated in the press coverage of this. So Senator Baucus, the great, met with single-payer advocates. He actually let them talk to him, which was already amazing. And that was it. That was the news story. There was no coverage by the mainstream press of what was said. They simply said, oh, well, he met with them, it's cool, but didn't discuss the content of the discussion, which is, given the amount of text space and news time that's been devoted to discussing, you know, this wonderful, generous offer that the health insurance plans have made to, you know, slow down their rate of increase by 15% is, well, nothing short of amazing. Now, we hunted around, and Charlie, my producer, is very good at web searching, and we were able to find out on a blog the actual content, which I'm about to share with you. And we're about to find out, my friends, if we're in a democracy or a corporatocracy. And it's up to us to figure that out. Now, while Baucus continues to aver that single payer cannot pass the legislature at this meeting, Baucus did a number of things. He did agree to use his power of office to have the charges dropped against the Baucus 13, those doctors, nurses, and advocates who were arrested for chanting single payer from the gallery. He also said, well, maybe you could sponsor a health committee hearing on single payer, Chris Dodd being the health committee chairman. And Baucus said, well, let me think about it. They also asked that he have the Congressional Budget Fine Office score do a financial analysis of single-payer legislation and put it up there in addition to the other health bills it scores. Wouldn't that be interesting? They also asked him to support legislation to allow federal waivers for individual states to allow a single-payer systems. I was listening to Bill Maher last night, and one of my guilty pleasures on TV is Politically Correct, and he pointed out that the right seems to be a states' right advocate when it suits them. That's just fine for, you know, states are not allowed to pass more liberal drug legislation like, let's say, medical marijuana. No. We can't legalize marijuana, but we certainly can outlaw abortion. That's a states' rights issue. Well, maybe we can just turn the tables on them and make healthcare a states' rights issue, because I would love to see what the states came up with. And maybe somewhere out there, we would find a model for a system that would work. And we have placed on the website a lot of new links relating to single payers and some resources and a link to the blog that I'm talking about, which is called Tom Blog, TPMK. Well, I'm not going to read it to you. There's a link on the website. I also want to take this moment, and I won't stay on the soapbox for long, I promise, because we do have callers waiting. But Lorna Grundemann made a point last week in our interview that I want to emphasize. She said basically it has to be a grassroots movement and it has to be a big one. And my friends, the time is now. We've got to dig ourselves out of this mess. It's just plain nuts. And a piecemeal solution isn't going to cut it. We have to cut the insurance companies and their profit-taking ways out of the system. We don't need to be flushing 35% of our healthcare dollar to Wall Street. We don't need to be doing that. Nobody else on the planet does it. Nobody else has health costs being the major reason for personal bankruptcies. Latest statistics show that 50% of bankruptcies in this country, personal bankruptcies of households, people just like you and me, are middle-class people who had health insurance when they got sick, but then they lost their job. Oops, lost your insurance. Guess what? Bankruptcy and selling your house is next. This is nuts. This from the Mercury News. We're being urged to, Obama himself is urging us to have block meetings, neighborhood meetings, and engage in organizing, grassroots, community organizing. So go to BarackObama.com. You'll find a link to Organizing for America there. And in that, you'll find tools to reach your legislature. And those of you who are in California, take a look at who's on the committee. Take a look at what states they are part of. Do you know anyone? Do you have any Facebook friends who live in those states? Do you have any way of getting people who live in those states to write to their congressman? Heck, write the letter for them and send it as an attachment and ask them to pass it on as theirs. We need massive, massive inbox action here. We need, in the title, support for single payer. Listen to the single payer people, things like that. We need to really stir the pot. Otherwise, what we'll get is a piece of feel-good, halfway legislation, which will simply allow for another 35% of the new money that we pour into it, trying to cover everybody, to get covered with lousy coverage, with high deductibles that looks like health insurance, but when push comes to shove, you're bankrupt if you get sick. Now, the good news is that the Democrats do strongly support a good public option plan. And hopefully the public option plan would rapidly become the plan of choice for everyone, because it wouldn't be pulling all those dirty tricks. It wouldn't be pseudo insurance. It wouldn't be full of gotchas. The gotchas have just driven me insane. And the gotchas on my side are nuts as a doctor. The gotchas on the patient side are nuts. And we all get buried under the minutiae of these Byzantine rules, and in the end up having our pockets picked. There has to be a better way. And if there was ever a moment to affect social change, it's now. So every Sunday, every one of you, I want you, if you're a listener to the show, write a letter, just one. Try to get heard. Try to get heard out of state, in other states besides California. If you have a member of that committee, of the Senate Finance Committee or the Senate Health Committee, if you have a member who's your representative, write them every week. Keep writing. They don't pay attention to how many times you write. They just count numbers. So please, you can even stay on your tush and write these letters. So please, we've got to do something now. All right. I am stepping off of the soapbox. We're going now to Lee in Monterey. Hello, Lee, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I have a question for you. In May of this, actually last month, I had the cataract surgery. Prior to the surgery, I went to see my primary doctor, and he measured my blood pressure and EKG, and everything were fine. And on the 18th, which is the day for the surgery, my blood pressure way up to 200.
How old are you?
75.
Okay.
My question is, do those drops I took prior to the surgery really affect, elevate my blood pressure?
No, I don't think so. I think what was elevating your blood pressure was the possibility of someone taking a sharp object and sticking it into your eye. When we anticipate something that makes us nervous, even no matter how courageous we are, we can be very courageous, but we will still have a rise in a hormone in our bloodstream called adrenaline. And that, in fact, being courageous means fighting your fear and transcending it, but that doesn't mean that the adrenaline isn't there. Some people enjoy adrenaline and actually do things to raise it for fun, like extreme skiing or skydiving. And when a person is older, there is a mechanism that gets a little slow. And this is how we avoid having a high blood pressure from adrenaline. Under normal circumstances, when the blood vessel wall is very healthy, it will produce a substance called nitric oxide very rapidly when the adrenaline goes up. The adrenaline makes the blood vessel walls want to tighten, and the nitric oxide relaxes it. As we age, we don't produce as much, and so an extreme situation like going into surgery is very likely to raise your blood pressure.
But what you are saying, that because I anticipated the procedure, that's why my blood pressure, because prior to the surgery, I was in the surgery center, which they put those like atropine to dilate my
eye.
And prior to that, I used the same thing, atropine at home, and Vigamox and Zebron. And after that, I went back to see my primary doctor, and he prescribed me to Azor for the blood pressure. Because when I came back to see him, he was very surprised, because he has taken care of me for last 20 years.
Well, let me understand the situation more clearly then. You were kept on atropine drops? You're supposed to use them all the time now?
No, I use it 3 days prior to the surgery.
Yes, and
twice
and,
a day.
And now you're no longer using the atropine?
No, I'm no longer. After surgery,
And your blood pressure is still remains high?
Right now, it's about 160 over 80.
And what was it, say, a month ago, before any of this started?
A month ago, it fluctuates during the day, but average about 135 over 75.
All right, so it's gone up significant amount, 5 points on the diastolic, which is probably the more reliable number. And this happened after your surgery and has continued to be high?
During and after.
During, I'm not surprised. When let me just explain that when I do an annual exam on a woman, it involves a personal kind of invasion of her genitals. And in general, I find that the blood pressure goes up 10 to 15 points at that exam. And so I never make a diagnosis of hypertension based on results during an invasive procedure. And I consider a pelvic to be an invasive procedure because the psychological defense mechanisms kick up the adrenaline. That it has continued to be high perplexes me. And I don't see that the atropine could be having, that you took now several weeks ago, could be having a permanent effect on your system. So I'm at a loss for an explanation.
I'm going to see my doctors probably 2 weeks from now. I have second question about the Azor,
that's the blood pressure lowering medication.
Right. And I see here two numbers, 5 milligram and 20 milligram.
Yes.
Well, what do they mean?
Well, the Azor is one of a great number of combination medications where they have two drugs in one. The idea is that people don't like to take a lot of pills, and so if we put two pills in one, two drugs, I should say, in one pill, that this will make people feel better about taking pills. Now, I don't use Azor, and I'm off the top of my head, I believe that it is a combination of a calcium channel blocker and a angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor. And I think it's the same as Norvasc, and I don't remember what the ACE inhibitor is. So I will, I'll try to get that information for you on this show and look that up online. But AZOR is the name of the drug. But anyway, it's a combination antihypertensive, which you may or may not need long term. And I'm hoping that you don't need it long term because, you know, we try not to use any unnecessary drugs. A couple of things that lower blood pressure I want to mention is walking 20 minutes a day and eating at least 7 1/2 cup servings of fruits or vegetables a day and taking extra calcium, about 1,500 milligrams a day. And all three of these things together will lower blood pressure in most individuals as much as one hypertensive drug. So if you can do all of those things and then be really diligent about that for a couple of weeks and then
I'm a very active person.
Yes, but okay, so you've got the active down, get the fruits and vegetables and the calcium in, do that for 2 weeks, then go to your doctor and ask him if you can try being off of the Azor and see if your blood pressure will stay in the normal range. Another thing, by the way, that lowers blood pressure is fish oil, omega-3 fatty acids, but you have to take about 2,000 milligrams of EPA. 2,000 milligrams of EPA, which is more than most people take in order to get that blood pressure lowering effect. But it might be worthwhile to try to get off the medication over the next several months.
I will do that.
And I was right, by the way. It's amlodipine and olmesartron. So it's not an angiotensin-converting enzyme. It's a ARB, which is an angiotensin receptor blocker. But it effectively acts on two different things that control blood vessel tension and that control the kidneys' retention of fluid. And what you're trying to do with those drugs is lower blood pressure. And it's a good drug. I don't say anything bad about it, but I never use combination drugs because I'm trying to use the minimum number of drugs. And this is just my reading of the literature and a philosophical position. I also find that it costs more money. My patients would rather pay for the generic and take two pills, for the most of them would anyway.
Well, is it in the form of beta blocker?
No, it's not. It has no beta blocker in it at all.
Okay, great. So, and I thank you very much
for
explaining.
Thank you for the call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Going to read a quick email here. This one from Karen in Battle Creek, Michigan. Karen is a avid listener. I responded to one of her emails a couple of weeks ago, and she called to thank me. And I just want to thank Karen for the fan mail and also let her know that we are listening and we do try to answer the emails when we feel they'll be relevant. This one from Gail in Aptos. She had a question about a show last week when I did that little news bit about using DHEA to treat osteoporosis. She wants to know whether it would be a problem with a drug called Cellcept that she takes, and the answer is no. There's no interactions there. In terms of the dose for DHEA for prevention of osteoporosis, what you really want to do is look at blood levels, since depending upon which of the forms of DHEA that you get over-the-counter, absorption is all over the map. So how much gets into your system is a real, well, let's call it a crapshoot. So what you should do is look at blood levels. Have your doctor measure your serum DHEA and then use blood levels to get to the mid-range of that. Now, if you're taking that much DHEA, and it could be 150 to 250 milligrams a day, you should make sure that you get your annual mammograms, because DHEA can be converted into estrogen, and for men, it can be converted into testosterone, which isn't a bad thing, but you want to be watching out for the prostate cancer. If you've got prostate cancer, you know, the whole thing about should we screen for PSAs or not, if you're taking a drug that's going to act as growth hormone for a prostate cancer, then I monitor the PSAs, and I recommend anyone on testosterone or DHEA monitor either their PSA if they've got a prostate or their mammograms annually if they have breasts, because I do feel that there is at least theoretically a risk of increasing the amount of sex hormones around and thus creating a grow signal for any cancer that should arise. I want to emphasize, I don't believe this gives you cancer. I believe that if you get cancer, it might make it grow faster. Let's go to Helen in Aptos. Hello, Helen, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. I have two short questions. What is the best way to detoxify the body after chemotherapy? And what is the name of the component a person can take to raise the white blood count after chemotherapy depletion?
All right. When you say the component, you're referring to the injectable?
Well, I believe there's an injectable. Is there something that you also take orally?
Not to my knowledge, okay. Not in terms of conventional oncology.
Okay.
The granulocyte colony stimulating factor is given by injection.
Okay. What do you call it?
You know, I forget the trade name for granulocyte colony stimulating factor, but if you just say that.
Granulate?
Granulocyte. Like granulated sugar.
Uh-huh.
Except
site
uh-huh. stimulating factor.
Okay.
Yeah, colony stimulating factor, and I'm sure you know how to spell those words. So those are heavy-duty drugs that are essentially cloned versions of hormones that our own bodies produce.
Mm-hmm.
And they are completely appropriate in the case of bringing the white count back up after chemotherapy. With respect to things that you can do to support your body,
to detoxify the chemicals,
the main thing that you want to do after chemo is all of these drugs have to be processed by the liver. So you want to support phase two detoxification.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an excellent discussion of phase one and phase two detoxification in the archives. If you look for the interview with Dr. Jeffrey Bland, Bland,
mm-hmm.
there's one on detoxification that really walks you through it. And he's a great teacher. He's one of my real mentors and role models in terms of his knowledge base. And
is he on your website?
He is. You can go to the archives and hear about that. But in brief, sulfur-containing compounds, and this would include all of the cruciferous vegetables like cauliflower, kale, broccoli. Broccoli sprouts are a particularly high level of indole-3-carbinol, which is one of the main things that you're after. But essentially, you want a lot of sulfur. You want foods that contain glucuronidates, so glutamine, which is available at health food stores.
Glutamine
is a good supplement to be taking. Mm-hmm. And sulfur, and something like milk thistle is good because milk thistle slows down phase one detoxification. Mm-hmm. So, and it also speeds up phase two. So it has a biphasic effect, both of them good. Okay. Our concern with chemo drugs is as they're broken down by the body, they're first rendered more dangerous, kind of like heating up something and then quenching it in a bucket of water. Mm-hmm. That quenching process needs to happen rapidly. Mm-hmm. And that's the phase two detoxification. Mm-hmm. Other things that are helpful, making sure that you have at least one good soft bowel movement a day. Two is better. So taking extra fiber, using extra water to try to get things through. And dry saunas with, again, lots of water. And what you're trying to do there is sweat out what you can't poop out. And I have found acupuncture to be extremely helpful in and supportive for the symptoms of chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. I've never seen any data at all that it's helpful with detoxification from the standpoint of speeding that up. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, the interview in the archives is April 22nd, 2006. Charlie is at the helm providing me with all the things I can't remember.
Okay.
And he also says that Wikipedia says that that granulocyte colony stimulating factor is just called GCSF.
Well, thank you. It's been very helpful.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye. The most important thing, by the way, in terms of detoxification from cancer therapy is detoxification from fear and turning your thoughts towards health and happiness and being in the moment and giving every day of your life meaning, because what happens, fear is a very toxic thing, and the fear and stress that it creates lowers your immunity further. In fact, in studies of athletes and people taking exams, we've found that competing like in a statewide final swim championship and taking a stressful exam both reduce your secretory immunity, which is the antibodies coming out of your saliva and in your intestines, drastically by like 90% for a day or two. So there's a huge hit from allowing yourself to continue to be afraid. And that's maybe the best advice I can give anyone who's living with cancer is, you know, work to be in the moment and not in this fearful future. And thanks to the caller who called in with the name for granulocyte colony stimulating factor. You know, they have to give it something catchy. It's Neupogen or Neulasta. In another life, I would like the job where they pay me, you know, a couple hundred thousand a year to sit around and think up names for drugs, because that's just a fun job. Let's go to Steve in Pacific Grove. Hello, Steve. Welcome to the program.
I am interested in hearing your comments on optimal nutritional supplementation to maintain cognition in a 55-year-old. I'm a healthy person. But what I notice, and I eat well, I exercise, I am in a very happy space in my life. But what I notice is in terms of my cognitive abilities, it's not just an issue of memory, but what I notice is where previously almost below the level of conscious thought, my mind would put together multiple facts and present an answer to my conscious mind that was immediately there for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now I realize those synaptic connections just no longer occur that way. And I feel I'm too young to be experiencing that. It's just amazing to me. Sometimes I'll realize an answer to something later and know in myself that previously, that answer would have been immediately in my mind without a single thought about it. And now it may be a week before an answer pops into my mind to something I've previously been thinking about.
Okay, so this isn't a multitasking issue. It's really a processing issue, is what I'm hearing.
Processing issue, yes.
Okay. Well, no, I'm sorry to say you're not too young. Anyone past about 45 is fair game for what we're now calling minimum cognitive decline. or minimum cognitive deficit, depending upon who you read. But we've got new initials. That must mean there's a drug out there on the horizon. But yeah, there's some real potential for cognitive decline fairly early. Just got back from a conference about this at the annual functional medicine conference. And what's going on is inflammatory. It's actually inflammatory in the brain. And so there's a couple of things that you should get tested to see where the potential targets are, because you can go to Dr. Perlmutter's website, which is very commercial, although I think the information is very good. He's the brain recovery site. And like I said, the information's good, but it feels very commercial. But the research is solid. The idea is that sometimes it's inflammatory, sometimes it's hormonal, and you want to sort that out. So there's a test called urine organic acids, where you look at the breakdown products of various things in digestion. And one of those breakdown products will tell you whether you have a inflammatory issue in the brain. And that's really important. Has your sleep shifted?
That is kind of an issue for me. I am sometimes, fairly frequently actually, waking up at around 2:30 in the morning. And sometimes I just go right back to sleep, but sometimes I may be awake for a couple of hours after that.
When did that start?
It's been a couple of years, I think.
Okay. Does it track reasonably well with the cognitive changes you've noticed, or are those very recent?
Oh, I definitely notice if I have a few nights in a row of that kind of mid-morning insomnia, that it'll definitely affect me.
All right.
Sure. You know, I take no sleep meds.
Well, that's okay, but I'm just, you know, I'm trying to help you narrow down the amount of testing that would need to be done. As Willie Sutton is said to have said about banks, where the money is for you is probably in hormonal testing. Look at your stress hormones. Look at cortisol. Best way to look through at cortisol with saliva, because it's very impractical to draw your blood four times in a single day. And you're looking for a cortisol curve. You can also check melatonin levels. You should do that. You should do cortisol and melatonin. And where are you? Pacific Grove. Okay, well, you could come see me and we can do it. You can find another functional medicine doctor and do it. Many naturopathic doctors know how to do this. It's not part of conventional medicine. We are outside of conventional medicine when we talk about this. Not that it's not scientific, but just it's not part of endocrinology or internal medicine as they are practiced in this country. So you're not going to get much help from your primary care doc, unfortunately. But fixing the sleep cycle and seeing if you have hormonal perturbations. And when I say hormones, I'm talking thyroid, adrenal gland, which is your cortisol curve, looking at your testosterone, your estrogen and your progesterone levels. You're looking at your DHEA. We talked about that a few minutes ago. And seeing what is out of balance. Because once the sleep cycle is disrupted, you know, that and the minimum cognitive deficit probably go together. And you can use the sleep cycle as an indicator that you're on the right track and anticipate that the neurotransmitters, which are all, by the way, many of the neurons in your brain have hormone receptors for cortisol, for DHEA, for testosterone, for estrogen. When these things are out of balance, your thoughts aren't as razor sharp as they used to be. So I think rather than looking in the inflammatory basket, I would probably look in the hormone basket first because of what you told me about sleep. Although it's all linked together, you know, it's this big complex web and you twang one string and all the other strings vibrate. But I think your leverage point is probably there.
All right. So you would say diagnose that first and then look at supplementation?
Or? Yeah, because, you know, the trouble with the sort of first level thinking is that we've grown up in this drug culture. And so we sort of think, well, if there's a drug, herbs are just, you know, safer drugs. They're just drugs that are, all I need to do is find the herb or the one or two herbs. And that's overly simplistic, quite honestly. When you're dealing with a complex system, it's nice to know what's wrong with it so you know which supplements and what kind of feedback loop. You can put stuff in your mouth. You could go pick up, for example, melatonin, 3 milligrams, 1 to 3 milligrams. I'd start with a low dose and take that a half an hour before bedtime and try to fix your sleep. I mean, that would be sort of your basic 101 kind of approach. Won't hurt you, may not do anything because you may not be, you know, leveraging the right issue. And then you're like, okay, well, that didn't work. And well, maybe it didn't work because you weren't in the context where it could work. So simple first line things, melatonin is good for sleep, valerian, also good. Sometimes you can get a little hangover from it, so you got to watch the dosing on that. I like chamomile and passion flower, and there's lots of sleep aids with magnesium, chamomile, and passion flower together. You can find 24 at the nearest health food store. And those work for some people, and as a first-line kind of now-and-then fix-it therapy, that's fine for sleep. For someone who's getting to the point where they're also seeing decline in brain function, I think that's a little bit more serious, and you probably need to target it in a bit more of an analytical way.
All right. All right, well, thank you for that information. I have written it all down, because otherwise I would not have remembered it.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Okay, off-air question. What do I know about chia seed? Same as used in the chia pet? Supposed to be good fiber and antioxidant? Yep, I have heard of chia seed being used as fiber. As far as its antioxidant properties are concerned, you'd have to chew it pretty well because you need to be able to absorb it for antioxidant purposes, unless you're talking about a local gut antioxidant. The off-air caller also wanted to know about geranium nebium, and I'm sorry, I do not know anything about that specific compound, so I can't help you there. This is a really cool email. I want to be sure I share this with you. This is from Judith in Atlanta. Dear Dr. Don, at the end of March, I gashed my leg and did not seek medical attention. Not smart. The wound eventually stopped bleeding, but after 3 weeks, when it had not really started healing, I finally went to a clinic. The physician didn't do anything other than give me antibiotics and refer me to a wound care specialist. I waited another week to see the specialist. His take was that there was an underlying reason for the delayed healing, and he recommended ordering a fasting blood test, fasting blood sugar. I was fairly positive that type 2 diabetes was involved, and I didn't have the insurance and would never get insurance again if I tested positive, so that I finally took action on my own. I went home and threw out my Coke and my white bread. Then I got on your website and found the segment on type 2 diabetes and followed it. 6 weeks later, I'm down from a size 18 to a 14 and my leg is almost healed. I still have another 40 pounds to go, but I finally have broken my addiction to sugar and refined carbohydrates. I still want them, but I'm also repulsed by my overeating. The reason I'm writing is to tell you about steviosides and how they made a big difference to me. Steviosides are not the ingredient that was approved for use in sweeteners, that's Reb A, but is found in the sweetener Sweet Leaf, which is 60% steviocide and 40% Reb A. The information I could find on it is that it's used in South America to treat diabetes and has a positive impact on blood pressure. Once I started using 2 packets a day, my legs started healing faster. I noticed since I stopped taking it after 5 days, since I hate artificial sweeteners, and my progress slowed. So I've now added Sweet Leaf to my life since I intend to be healthy and stay healthy without worrying about having some sugar in my life. The main problem with stevia extracts is that 85% come from China, and steviocide and stevia are used interchangeably. Sweet Leaf is made in this country and appears to think quality control is important. The best part from your perspective, I think, is that the product doesn't appear to have harmful effects if your blood sugar and blood pressure are normal. And she sent an attached article which talked about absorption of the steviocides and elimination of the steviocides, but was really not a long-term study in terms of long-term safety. I will point out that because this is a plant leaf, grows on the planet, things that grow on the planet, generally people have had a chance to develop processes for eliminating them, new-to-nature molecules, as Jeff Bland says in that detoxification interview I mentioned earlier, are a little more problematic because who knows if our body has a system for dealing with them. We're going now to Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello, Maria Elena.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you about a drug called Provigil, which I gather is for people who have sleepiness problems, but it seems to focus concentration. And that's all I know about it.
Okay, well, that's fine. I will tell you more about it. Provigil is actually FDA approved for only one indication, and that indication is a rare disorder called narcolepsy. The actual chemical name is modafinil, M-O-D-A-F-I-N-I-L, like modafinil. Sounds like a last-minute fashion show. Anyway, Provigil, I usually don't gag at drug commercials. It's rare that they actually make me gag. This one did. This one was like the most egregious, abusive, and I hope they got lots of complaints because they did pull the commercial. But it basically had your typical exhausted soccer mom, right? And she's got the 3 kids, one's in a tutu and one's wearing like
baseball uniform and the other's got, I don't know, some other sports uniform, probably soccer. And she's in a big SUV and, you know, the kids are jabbering and jumping around and she's looking really tired and glum. And, you know, they talk about, ask your doctor if Provigil is right for you. And of course, in the next frame, they've got her, you know, happy and perky and playing with the kids. And they're all singing as they drive down the road to the soccer lesson. And they show the logo of the drug and then they give that like really fast little thing that tells you all the things that go wrong if you take this drug. It was just so awful. And that's advertising for an off-label use. So I hope they got smacked by Bush's FDA, although I won't hold my breath. Maybe we'll get a little bit more action if they fund the FDA. But that's another conversation. The issue here is that this has rapidly become one of the most widely abused college campus drugs. It's about $10 a pill. There's a black market. It does sharpen your concentration. It makes it easier for you to take tests and to pull an all-nighter for sure. And it is a completely uninformed use. We have no data on the long-term brain effects of this drug. We have no idea what it's going to do when it's used in people whose brains, we all know that high school students' brains have not fully developed. What's perhaps a secret to most of us is that your brain neurostructure never stops developing, but it really doesn't even slow down until your early 20s. So a lot of people are using this drug and probably influencing how their synapses are being laid down in a way that could have permanent long-term effects, possibly, who knows what, you know, early dementia, late dementia. We just have no idea. And to be giving this widely as a performance-enhancing drug is just about as smart as taking steroids to have big muscles so that you can hit a home run in high school. It's just plain dumb. So, you know, if you've got narcolepsy, fine. Go and take Provigil. It's a wonderful thing for you because otherwise you're going to fall asleep driving and run into a freeway pylon or something like that. You know, what people need is they need less caffeine and more sleep. You know, we're down to an average of 6.5 hours of sleep in this country. And at the turn of the century, the average was 9 hours of sleep. I don't think human physiology has shifted. I don't think we've evolved that much in 100 years. So 1800s into the 1900s, that last century. But anyway, stay away from that stuff. That's just a plain bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't feel so bad. If I need 9 hours of sleep, I really do feel like I need 9 hours of sleep. I feel better when I have that much. And, you know, current civilization is so much more stressful than it used to be, I think. So maybe 9 hours is a good thing.
Maybe 9 hours is what we're supposed to have. I personally am a 9 hour girl. And yes, I can get by with less, but if I am on vacation or I'm in any kind of situation where I can just fall asleep and wake up and not, you know, worry about it, I invariably drop into a 9 hour cycle. And I've been through medical internship in the United States in the 1980s. That means living on 4 hours of sleep on the average a day and some days none at all. And yeah, it affects your brain function big time, as well as a lot of other things. But, you know, more caffeine or more booting up is not a good idea. I'll tell you the thing I really worry about with the Provigil. I mentioned early dementia. I'm not kidding about that. There's a thing in the brain called the NMDA receptor. And this receptor responds to a hormone called glutamate, which is why people are worried about NutraSweet and aspartame, is because it gets converted to glutamate and people are concerned that maybe it could kill brain cells. Too much glutamate definitely kills brain cells. And that's one of the reasons that inflammation and stress kill brain cells. And I do worry that when you do something unnatural, like rev up your brain cells, let's say you also did a couple of liters of diet soda with NutraSweet in it because you're trying to get through the exams. I really worry what the long-term effects could do if you could be taking out brain cells in your 30s that were slated to go out in your 60s. And we just don't have the answer. And, you know, it makes me nervous because theoretically, it's very plausible that we could be causing brain damage. So until they prove it doesn't, I'm not taking it. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Got a quick question here from Jenny in Clovis, California. And Jenny writes, would you please discuss the types of incontinence and the use of heavily marketed items such as the Pfizer products Detrol LA and Toviaz? In addition to behavioral changes and Kegel exercises, are there other options? Thank you, P.S. Your wonderful show is very much appreciated and keeps me busy harassing my representatives and senators about single-payer health insurance program. Well, Jenny and Clovis, do you have any relatives in the Midwest? Start trying to get them to harass their senators. Even people who feel safe, I think, would feel a lot safer if we had a true safety net for health insurance in this country. The types of incontinence. There's basically three. And the first one I'll just dispense with. Typically, you're going to see this in people with spinal cord injuries and post-surgery. And what happens in these cases is the bladder doesn't empty on its own, and it basically fills up, blows up to the size of a bowling ball, and then it empties because there's so much pressure in there that it has to flow out. That's called overflow incontinence, and those are the people you would typically see it in. Now, that's relatively rare and doesn't concern most of the ambulatory audience. The most common type of incontinence that I see in my practice is in women, and it's called stress incontinence. And the stress is anything that increases your intra-abdominal pressure. So it's a stress to the bladder, a physical stress. That means sneezing, position change, coughing, laughing. Anything that increases the pressure there causes the bladder to leak. And that's because the pelvic structure has relaxed and has gotten a little bit loose. I like to talk about the bowling ball and the hammock. If you've got the hammock tied really tight, the hammock is your pelvic floor muscles, against two trees, and you drop a bowling ball in it, the hammock will sag, but the bowling ball won't hit the lawn. On the other hand, if you've got the hammock tied loosely and you drop the bowling ball into it, well, bump, down it goes. And that bump represents a loss of the kink in your urethra, and when you lose that kink, you squirt out a little bit of urine. So stress incontinence is the one that responds to Kegel exercises most commonly. It also can be fixed surgically, although a lot of the surgical fix patients either don't get a complete result or they get too much and they have problems with urinary retention, in extreme cases leading to the overflow incontinence I discussed earlier. The third type is urge incontinence, and urge incontinence affects males and females. In Chinese medicine terms, it's considered a loss of kidney qi, of strength of the kidney energy, which occurs in midlife to old age, somewhere in there. And it does respond nicely to acupuncture, I'm happy to say. And I've been particularly impressed in a few patients that I've been treating recently, one in particular, a multiple sclerosis patient with incontinence. They've responded really well to ear needles, and ear needles are simple and quick and easy to do. And if you can make a difference by popping a couple of needles into someone's ears once every couple of weeks, that's much better than drug therapy from a long-term safety standpoint. The drugs themselves are all basically anticholinergics. So anyone who's ever taken an antihistamine or smoked marijuana may have had the effect of not being able to pee very easily or feeling like they have to kind of push to get the stream started. That's because acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter that makes you pee. And if you block acetylcholine, it's harder for your bladder to squeeze itself out. These drugs interfere with that, and they also cause dry mouth, it causes blurred vision because you can't focus your eyes, because unfortunately, drugs that go all over the body, you put them in the bloodstream. Behavioral changes are largely, well, acetylcholine, right? What do we do with Alzheimer's disease? Well, we try to increase brain acetylcholine because people think better. And so what happens if you block acetylcholine? You don't think as well. So that's pretty obvious. Ultimately, I think where these drugs have their place is airplanes, fishing trips, long car rides, and movies. And when I do use them in patients who have this problem, what I have them do is take the pill as needed for those circumstances where you can't get to a bathroom. And that's, I think, a rational use of the drugs. I don't think that long-term daily use of an anticholinergic is necessarily the best idea, and I would always look for other solutions. Oh, one trick, by the way, if you do have mild urge incontinence from time to time, and it's just a now-and-then thing, certain part of your menstrual cycle, for example, if you tighten up all the pelvic muscles really, really hard for about 15 seconds, you will induce a spinal reflex relaxation of the bladder detrusor muscle. If you really concentrate and really tighten up, you can get the bladder to relax if you're having one of those spasms. Let's go now to Roxanne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Roxanne, and thank you for your call.
Hi.
Hi.
You know what? I hope I'm not imagining this, but I've started taking blood pressure medicine. And I've changed several medicines because they either didn't agree with me. I have a 4-year-old in the background. Sorry.
That's all right.
And my legs are swelling.
Uh-uh.
And I'm on Cozar right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the odd thing happened after the, I can't even remember the last blood pressure I was on before this, but about a week before I started the Cozar because of swelling legs from the last blood pressure medicine, that my legs finally went down.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have access to my doctor, but like every couple weeks. And so I went ahead and started taking the new drug, which was Cozar, and my legs swelled up again. Now I have heavy legs.
Right.
I feel like they weigh a ton when I try and walk. I've had a blood clot,
mm-hmm.
and it landed in my lungs.
Uh-oh.
So this is what I'm wondering. Is it possible, because a blood clot happened after I started taking the blood pressure medications, is it possible the blood clot itself was caused by all this leg swelling? And
let me get the timeline straight here first. You start blood pressure medications when? How long ago?
Probably 5 months ago.
5 months ago.
4 or 5.
Okay. And then first you get the leg swelling.
Right.
And then when did you get the phlebitis? When did you get that blood clot?
I don't know.
Well,
I think that I got it, let's see.
When did it go to the lungs?
In March.
Okay, that's fine. So it, usually it's a fresh blood clot that goes to the lungs. If the blood clot's been there for more than a week,
uh-huh.
it actually kind of glues itself together. It's kind of like those resin things like epoxy that you mix together, and eventually first you can move them and they're soft and then they harden up.
Right.
The blood clot does that too. So it's really only fresh blood clots that will travel, that little bits of them will fall off and travel.
I did have a swollen left leg.
Right. And what
before that's, it happened.
Right. And the swollen left leg is because your drainage is messed up. All right. And when one leg is more swollen than the other, that's a big red flag for the possibility of a blood clot.
Right, and that was missed.
Right, and it often is. When that happens, a couple things. First of all, that leg will never probably drain as well, and so that leg will always be more, for the rest of your life, wherever that blood clot came from.
Really?
Yeah, that leg will always tend to be more swollen than the other because you've lost your valves. The blood clots always form, unfortunately, around the valves, and the valves will scar. So you end up with a leaky valve. It's called post-phlebitic syndrome, and it basically means that you have to use compression hose and elevation to drain the fluid that's naturally going to want to accumulate in your leg. In a leg with good valves, there's a natural process. Every time you walk or tighten up the muscles, you kind of squeeze the blood up to the next valve. And so there's a series of valves on the way back up to the heart that hold the blood as it goes up. And so it's a series of, like, ratcheting effect almost, of like a car jack, you know, when you're jacking mm-hmm. up a car. Each little movement of the muscles jumps the blood another ratchet. And if one of the ratchets is not going to hold, then it jumps back down again, right? You with me on this?
Yes, I'm really understanding what you're saying, honestly.
Good. So once you've lost one of the tooth on the jack, you have to pump really fast to get past that area. And realistically, that doesn't work in the body. So what you end up doing is having to turn the leg upside down and drain the blood past the incompetent valve, or apply additional pressure, which is where the compression hose come in.
It does repair itself really quickly when I raise my leg.
Right, and that's because you're getting past that valve to the next valve, which is obviously a good one. So you haven't
mm-hmm.
blown out all your valves yet. It's symmetric swelling now? Both legs are equally swollen?
Yes.
All right. That's reassuring in a way, in the sense that, first of all, I think you probably are going to be stuck with compression hose. And when you exercise, first thing you do is lie down, get your ankles higher than your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Even a slant board in the morning before you get out of bed, you know, that's when you do your compression hose, switch your showers to bedtime. And your legs are going to be pretty small when you wake up in the morning. So before you get up and allow the fluid to accumulate in the ankles, you put on the compression hose. That'll help keep it. We're running out of time, so I'm going to kind of wind this off with saying that the blood pressure medicines do have an effect. Diuretics cause decrease in swelling, but calcium channel blockers cause a big increase, and I'm betting you were on one of those. Sometimes the swelling in the leg will rectify itself, and the body will adapt, and that may be what happened with the Cozar. You're going to have to keep searching to find a drug that works for you, but in the short run, do the hose and do the elevation. All right?
Thank you so much.
Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Well, time really flies. And we've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I. We've referred to a lot of things on the archives at AskDrDawn.com. I hope you'll follow up and take a look at those. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.